Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Will you please join me in a welcome to our speaker tonight, 40-minute speaker, Carla from Tahunga.
Hi, everybody. My name is Carla Rowell, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here tonight, and I want to thank you, Kathleen, for inviting me out here to share with you. You heard my better half about a month ago. He was here, and when you got done peeing your pants and laughing your ass off, then, you probably went home and stayed sober another day, so hopefully there'll be no drinking tonight either. And I want to thank Dawn for coming up, and we were just having a little surprise reunion here up front. You know, if you stay around long enough in AA, you start to, you stick your hand out one person at a time, you start to know people, and then you know them again, and you know them again, and you know them again, and when you see them coming, you don't do this, you know. We have a step for that, and when we met Scott in Florida, I've known Barrett since he got sober, and then I met Dawn maybe 6 or 8 months ago. I've known Doug for many years. Now I know him very well. And but none of us knew that we all knew each other until just a minute ago, and that's what the commotion was that you heard up there. It made it so hard for David to start the meeting. But I love that. I love being able to have an open heart and welcome people into my life, and that was not always so. If I could have come in here when I was new and just stolen what you had, if I could have just come in here and taken it and left and not had to talk to any of you, I would have done that. And the last moment I wanted to be in was this one. You know, I just didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be here now. I wanted to be in the future or just, a few minutes ago, but I never wanted to be here. I was just, my separation from alcohol, I believe to this today, 25 years later, was a call to wake up. Just a simple call to wake up. And I didn't want to. I didn't come in here thinking that was a great idea, but it was the last idea. It was the very last idea. There was nothing else. My sobriety date, September 25th, 1987. And I have to tell you that before that, I never did anything for 25 years in a row on purpose that was of any value. Anyway, I had to come here to learn how to live a life. You know, to be able to walk around and look you in the eye and to make mistakes and be all right. You know, fall down 7, get up 8. And when I got here, I would have told you I was an alcoholic because of my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And now I've been around here long enough to know that that'll give you an inventory. It didn't make me alcoholic. I know people who now and have read about people who live criminal minds kind of evil childhoods. You know, I mean, bad, bad, bad stuff. And when they pick up a drink of alcohol, it doesn't do for them what it does for me. They had to get their healing some other way. And I know people who lived charmed childhoods. I know people who had everything they wanted, everything they needed. They were loved and shown love. And yet, a lot of them sit right next to me in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol did exactly to them and for them what it did for and to me. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I just know that I am. And I'm glad I know that I am. I'm glad I know what's wrong with me, and I'm glad I know what the solution is. I don't want you to think my childhood was all bad anyway, though. I had a great time in elementary school. 4th, 5th, and 6th grade were just terrific. My mother was a single mother of two young daughters, and we moved around for the rent a lot. And so consequently, I was a new kid on the block a lot, and so I'd find my way into whatever new school we were going to this time, whatever it is we're doing, is it academics? I got to know all the answers. Are we playing softball? I got to be the best. We're running track. I got to be the first around the track, and I got to take it just one more level up, right? Something happens with my basic competitive instincts, and then I just got supercharged. And by the time 6th grade was over, I needed to be the first woman president. I wanted to be the first woman Major League Baseball player. I was going to be the first woman to run a 4-minute mile, By the time elementary school was over, I was tired and I needed a drink. Because when you're running the world in your 10, that's a big job. I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle. And I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business. But we played it back then. And I was at my friend Leonard's house and we were playing spin the bottle and passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey. And it was that summer right between 6th and 7th grade going up into junior high, you know. A lot of things were changing, you know, during that summer. A lot of things changing. My relationship with boys was getting a little bit different. And we were all kind of growing up a little bit. A lot of racial tension in the school where I went. I was the whites were the minority. And there was a lot of stuff going on. Bobby Kennedy had just been shot. Martin Luther King had just been shot. And all of my friends of color... Yeah, and us, there was just this tension that was going on in the homes, and it changed things radically. So all of this is going on. And anyway, I'm at my friend Leonard's house, and we're playing spin the bottle, and the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. But when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair, if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get, so much for fair. And I was just of a self-centered mind, you know. It never occurred to me to ask those pertinent questions like, do you have a girlfriend? Why would I want to know that? And alcohol really started to take a different presence in my life. I really started to make the connection that it would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. It really started to smooth the edges off my life. It did all the feeling for me. It did the growing up for me. You know, it seemed to connect me up to that power greater than myself that I never could seem to stay connected to. You know, and I believed in God. I knew there was some great presence that runs in and around and through us. I knew some energy, some force, some great, great loving power, but I just couldn't ever stay connected. And when I got a hold of alcohol and it got a hold of me that way, man, it's all I wanted to do. Well, I got a reputation I didn't understand nor could I take responsibility for in junior high, and a reputation like that goes through junior high pretty fast. You know, boys my age are looking at me funny and so were the girls. And after a while, what happens for me when my feelings get hurt, my pride kicks in and I start to back away from my life. And I started hanging out in the girls' room more than I did in the classroom and getting with the other girls who were backing away from their lives and bringing stuff from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets and we were hanging out. After a while, school, which was my last bastion of freedom, it was my last bastion of hope. You know, I really loved school. I loved everything about it. It was unemotional. You know, you go there, you do the work, you get the grade, boom. You know. And it kept my mind off what was going on at home. But after a while, it gets old, you know. And I've always thought of myself as having a gypsy heart, you know. And what I know today is that I'm kind of a runner. But all it took back then for me was a Willie Nelson song and a long, slow train whistle, and I'd get out there on the on ramps of the freeways going north and south and east and west, and I'd crawl in the car or the truck that pulled over and be on my way to somewhere else. Where I want to be, right? That's where I want to be. Anywhere but here. On my way. Gave me that feeling of hope. That's where the hope is. Just right over there. Consequently, I started spending a little time in some of the Southern California hotspots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall. And it went like that for a while. And we did that dance where it would send me home to mom and home to dad and that for a while. And I got to tell you, I was still hanging on. You know, for a little while, I had that double life. For a very small window of time, I lived that double life. Because, you know, I traded away any gifts and talents or God-given great things that God had given me. I started to trade them away pretty fast. But I hung on for a while. I hung on to the sports. I hung on to, the summer of my 14th year, the spring of my 14th year, I was playing softball. I was playing championship softball, inner city, drinking on the side, but coming in when, you know, trying to be there for, trying to hang on, you know, trying to be in there and live that life. And we played the Southern California championship game. I pitched and then switched off with a shortstop, and I made the winning catch. I caught this hard line drive out of shortstop. Last one, third out, we're done. We win, right? I'm carried off the field on the shoulders of my teammates. I mean, you just can't write anything better than that. And then October of the same year, I was in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, learning how to sell myself for money. Because I was chasing that effect that alcohol produced. Got a long ride hitchhiking from Santa Barbara all the way up into San Francisco. And one long ride, got lucky. Dropped off right in the middle of this town, this party town, you know. To my left was the Condor Club with Carol Doda on the marquee. To my right, there were hookers and dealers and pimps. Oh, my. You know? And our book talks about our alcoholic life seeming the only normal one. It certainly seemed that way for me. And the more I'd go out there on the road, the less I was able to reintegrate back into my own school. You know, it just seemed like it was just so different. I was different. When I was 15, I was admitted to a mental hospital. It was just almost over. I had been kicked out of school one more time and admitted by a court-appointed psychiatrist. He said, you've got to be in there for 2 weeks observation. I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. They were not talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration deep down in my gut I didn't know how to talk about. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous almost 15 years later that I heard someone describe it as like being a scream without a mouth. And I got that. I thought, you know. You really know. But back then they didn't know it. This was not a treatment center. It was a mental hospital. They didn't have a lot of treatment centers, and certainly not for adolescents back then. And they didn't really know a lot about alcoholism. And they weren't looking for it in kids as much, you know. There were a lot of drugs and stuff going on. But they were giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep. And I'd become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I looked like at 15. In fact, all these years later, you know, when I finally wound up on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous at 29 years old, finally out of ideas enough and tired enough and sick enough to find you interesting enough to start doing the things that you laid out for me, I know I discovered that I'm an alcoholic. And the way I know that was that I picked up the tools you handed me and I started to use them. And to this day, 25 years later, when I apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, I get better. And that's how I know. But it's experiential. I cannot stay sober on your sobriety. I can get hope from your hope. I can get hope from your experience. But I can only get experience from my experience. And besides that, I'm too neurotic to sit around here and watch all you guys get the goods. You know, sooner or later, I got to pick it up. And if you're new, I want you to. I hope that at some point you'll find it inspiring enough to pick up the tools and take some actions on your own behalf. Because we have to. I'm responsible for my own sobriety. We can throw it at you and pick you up and carry you to meetings and do all that stuff. We can come over and clean your house till the cows come home. We can cut your hair and clean you up and shower you down and all of that stuff. But eventually, there's something you got to do. It's got to happen inside you. It had to happen inside me. So I'm in this hospital, and if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And there were people, there were some people around me with some real serious illnesses, real schizophrenia, real manic depression, you know, and untreated, I look a lot like them. I look very, you know, I look like I'm running right along the same frequency that they are sometimes. And if you don't want to go crazy, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy, I've already told you, is boys. I love all the boys. But my favorites are those sexy, smoldering types. You know what I mean? You know, you just never knew when they were going to blow. You know what I mean? And I know we got some of them in here tonight, because I can see the smoke curling up from the corners. You know? Back then, I found them very interesting. You know, very exciting. And today I know that feeling is fear. So I stay away. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life. You know, music playing in the background of all this drama. You know, it just, oh. You know, we play those sentimental jailhouse songs, you know, like whoo, when will I see you again? And press our little faces up against the big bay window and long for what we couldn't have across the pool. They'd be staring back at us. Isn't that where it is, though, too, where you get it in that anticipation moment, that moment of anticipation where as soon as I get that, never in the getting, is it? You get it, you got to get another one. It's not enough, right? It's always in that, that little fantasy moment. But I remember one afternoon I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench and I was watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's one of the guys that blew. You know, when he blew, he threw a big old chair through the window. Now my next boyfriend, he blew and he threw a nurse through the window, but so that was progressive too. But he's gone. He's going. You know, they're usually in the nut house. They're hiding from junior prison sentence, like California Youth Authority. You know, most of them don't. They're like me. They're alcoholics or drug addicts or something, and they're. But they look, you know, they look crazy, and they're hoping maybe they are because they'd rather be there than California Youth Authority. But they can't hold themselves down, so they do stuff like Terry did, and so he's being cuffed and escorted, and he's off. He's being escorted off the grounds, and I'll never see him again. And I'm sitting outside on the smoke break bench, and I'm smoking my tragic cigarettes, and I'm channeling Greta Garbo, and I just can't believe this is happening. I'm heartbroken. And just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," and just walk away. God. I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. But I didn't see it. I didn't know that's what was going on. You know, I was always looking out there for what I thought was going to fix me. Always looking out there, right? And the trouble with that is what I was looking with. And the trouble with that is what I saw. I was always about half a bubble off what it was I thought I was looking at anyway. I'd always look for the counterfeit. I'd mistake arrogance for confidence. I'd mistake sex for love. I'd mistake brute strength for strength of character. And I'd get it up in my hot little hands and it would just dissolve where I stood because it wasn't it. I had to come to AA to learn that it's when I'm given of myself. It's when I'm thinking of you that gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. When I'm trying to see how I might help meet your needs. But I didn't know that then. I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. And I was a vision for you. It was almost a year later, and by that time I was not bathing or getting dressed because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting because that was just a whole different way to change my reality. It didn't have really anything to do with suicide. It was just a release. Another kind of release, because untreated, that's how I am. I ended up going over the wall one more time, the last time, with the love of my life. I'd met him there on that unit. And we lasted about 2.5 weeks. And oddly enough, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me. And it took me a little while, and it hurt my feelings to realize that he'd called her. No, come get her. She's right here. And then back in juvenile hall, sitting in front of a judge, waiting for placement. You know, my dad used to say, "They're just trying to buy you some time, Carla." And maybe he was right. And I ended up in a rehab and whatever they could do. You know, let's try the next thing. What's wrong with Carla? And I ended up in a girls' home at the end of all of that. All my adolescent life, I was locked up in one place or another. I pieced together my education that way. Wherever it was I was, they'd put me in the school that was there. And it somehow added up to a high school diploma at the end of all of it. But I ended up in this girls' home in Pasadena. And it was a small six girls lived there, and it was kind of like a halfway house where they're trying to teach you how to live, how to go out there and grocery shop and get a job and all of that stuff, because this is kind of your last chance before, you know, you're out there. And so I was going to school, and I met my roommate who was on the same page as I was, really spiritually. I mean, I've always been a spiritual seeker. I've never stopped looking. Even when I found alcohol, I just, you know, I knew, I just knew if I could find the right one, if I could just make that connection, it would just all come together for me. And You know, I've tried a lot of things. I mean, I was born into a Southern Baptist home, and that worked very well for my mother till the day she died just a few years ago, you know. I couldn't hear it. I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade, and, you know, that just... I'm about as deep as a mud puddle, you know what I mean? If it's not working right away, I gotta go. And then I tried burning black candles and praying to the other guy for a couple of years, you know. Just hedging my bets, you know. I just want to be on the side that's winning. I don't care. I don't. And then the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you might remember that show. Some of my best spiritual lessons ever, you know, came from that show. David Carradine was a star, you know. He played a Buddhist priest, and he was tough. I mean, he walked the Wild West in bare feet. You know what I mean? He was tough. He'd walk from town to town just ever so peacefully on his journey, you know, accepting life on life's terms. Sometimes he'd come into a town and he'd be met by a group of guys with great hostility. You know, they just didn't like the way he looked. They just didn't like the looks of him, and they'd verbally assault him. Ha! Ah! You know, and he just dropped some pearls of wisdom. Three or four words. You know. And they'd change. Their whole faces and everything, their demeanors would change, and they'd go off to help people. And I thought, that is power. There is power in that. Whatever that guy just said, you know, that was power. And then he'd walk to another town, and he'd be met with another group of guys with great hostility. You know, they didn't like the way he looked, and they'd assault him physically. You know, they'd come at him. Woof, we're going to kick your ass. And when they did that, he kicked theirs. And I wanted what he had. It seemed to me it was just strength and serenity personified. You know what I mean? It was just, we could do that. You know, there could be spirit, and there could be ass kicking. And, you know. So I get to this girl's home, and I've got all this rolling around in my head. That coupled with the idea of what the 60s, what I thought the 60s might have been had I been there. Now, the 60s were over in, you know, I was 12 in 69, so they were over and by the time I got out there. But I used to watch the news, and I saw what happened. You know, I mean, they marched. Those people marched. They didn't take crap. They marched. They said no. Right? And they had Crosby, Stills, and Nash and the Grateful Dead and Traffic and Blind Faith. You know, they had, you know, peace and love and flowers and free love. And, you know, so this is all rolled up in my head and in my spirit. And this is what I'm looking for. My roommate's on the same page. And we're talking to our friends, and our friends said, man, those people moved to Oregon. There are real people. Other people know about them, and they're in Oregon. So we went out the second story window of that girl's home, down the tree and into Randy's truck and off to Oregon where God might be. And we ended up in the Springfield, Eugene area for a little while. They rented a house and they let me come with them. And I thought my life was going to change from the outside in. You know, we all just want a new start, fresh start, right? So we get up there and we planted a garden in the front yard. That's when I learned that when they talk about hoeing, they meant with a tool. You know? Two things happened that I could see only looking back. I certainly couldn't see it while it was happening. And one was that I couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. And when I had no booze and I had no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. Very hard to get along with. My life quickly became your fault. And when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17 years old. And my friends had to ask me to leave. Of course they did. And I was asked to leave a lot. And I was heading down the road and took the long way around to end up back down in my father's house against his better judgment. But he let me come and stay with him for a little while. And we started by trying to get up in the morning. He'd go to work. And I had big hopes, big dreams, it's going to be, you know, fresh start. And he'd take off for work and I'd go sit in his den and I'd start drinking from his liquor cabinet. And he'd come home in the afternoon and I'd be sitting in the very spot where he'd left me that morning. And I'd have nothing to say for myself. I didn't know what to tell him. I didn't know I was afraid. I didn't know how to tell him. I didn't know where the last few years of my life had gone. And he'd have that look in his eye, you know, and I didn't know how to talk to that look. Right before my 18th birthday, just a few months later, he came to me and he said, what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could think of was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress, and I know today I must have misunderstood because I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. Not a lot of auditioning going on out there. And I was 18 years old, starting my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. Not a lot of hope about it getting any different. Life on life's terms in a whole different way. But alcohol was doing all the feeling for me. To this day, I love driving through Hollywood. I love going down Sunset Boulevard and seeing a whole new generation of the same girls sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different. Same bus stop. And I get to say a prayer of hope for her and a prayer of gratitude for myself. Maybe someday she'll get to find what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous if alcoholism is her problem. A few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard and I saw the light in his eyes and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off. And I moved in with him that night. I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later he's asking me to leave and I still don't know his last name. I was just one of those proverbial tornadoes. I just went through his life. He'd been nothing but kind to me. And even though he had problems of his own, he'd just been nothing but kind to me. And yet, boom, you know, we roar through the lives of others. He was on my 8-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly that I owed him amends. You know, in my first year of sobriety, I was doing the steps and his name came up, and I thought, you know, there's just some people that were ready, willing, and able. You know, before we even get done writing, we know, you know, there he is. And I spent the last part of my first year of sobriety looking for him, you know, just going wherever I knew to look, but the odds weren't great. I didn't know his last name, and chances were he wasn't there anymore. And after a while, my sponsor had to stop me, and she said, listen, if you're supposed to find that guy, you'll find him, but in God's time, not yours. You know, right now, you're chasing your tail anymore. You're being unproductive. It's just no good. You got to let it go. And she said, but in the meantime, there are some actions you can take, you know, to change your own behavior. Like, try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? You know, and lo and behold, all these years later, I have friends of both genders. I know how to be a friend. I know how to have a friend. There's not a room in the world that I can't walk into with my head up and look you in the eye. And I no longer get those looks of disdain and pity and contempt from men or women when I walk into the room. Right up there with that feeling of being useful is that feeling of self-respect. And you guys taught me how to have that. And the deal about that is nobody can take it from me. I can give it away, but you can't take it. And I love that. Right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel that runs my life. It's what I do that matters. And of course, I went out there and I gave that talk. I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know what I mean? I just didn't think it mattered. But I gave the talk, and of course I felt better. And when the receiving line came through at the end of that talk, this man stopped and he said, where were you in 1976? It was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety and I with almost 13. Now, only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get that done, just couldn't get it done. I couldn't get it done. I just like to tell that story because it reminds me all these years later, you know, it's a big reminder for me of, you know, when times are uncertain and we're in that period of groundlessness and you can't really see anything coming together ahead and you can't remember quite the last time something came together and you know it's all going to be okay, you just don't know how yet, and you keep walking and stories like that come up, you know, experiences like that come up for me. And it's mine. So I got to make those direct amends for him with him, and I took him to dinner, and I told him all that I knew to do and what I thought I needed to do to make amends. And he said, oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right. You know, if we're in this room tonight, we're the lucky ones. We're the lucky ones. Somehow, some way, we managed to slip through that window of grace one more day to come in here and sit together and recharge and regroup and see what we can go back out there and pack into the stream of life. Not everybody takes the gift. Not everybody holds on to it. Not everybody does what they need to do to keep it burning. So I left Hollywood and I hooked up with another boyfriend who came from a rehab, because that's where they keep the boyfriends, and or whatever it is you're looking for. And you know, again, we're flying on the coattails of the 60s, where, you know, our book talks about having moral and philosophical convictions galore, and we love that idea of peace and love and all that stuff. We just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love, you know. I want to be that, but I am this. I want to be there, but I have to be this. I can't get from here to there. And I see it, but I can't touch it. So we beat each other up and down the California coast and pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin we found way up on 5 miles in and off the highway and 5 miles up a mountain. And this old burnout mining claim, and threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight until the baby came. And then we had this little girl, and I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank. We all know that alcoholism doesn't care who you love. It's supposed to be a little girl, boyfriend, booze, and everything else. And it became booze and little girl and everything else. She got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her somewhere else, up the road where the hope is, on our way. We went up to Idaho, and I got three jobs. I was trying to get into the legitimate world of working, right? And I had three jobs, tending bar and cocktail waitressing. And any normal person could have made a great living doing what I was doing. It never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? You know, it just seemed to me it was very efficient. But I couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time, so we lived in the little rent-by-the-week motels up there. My kid was one of those kids that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And after a while, Idaho's not working for us anymore either. We're back down in L.A. I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina. I've got a job in Hollywood tending bar, about 35, 40 miles between each other. My daughter was almost 4 years old by then, and every afternoon I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood, and I'd stop at the halfway point, which is a bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin, stop there and have my afternoon get-ready drinks, shots of Corvo Gold and Bud Bax, have the drinks and get up off the stool and go out to Hollywood and pour drinks with everybody until the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye, as I had done for months on end, and I took off and I stopped at that same bar in Arcadia. I had those same drinks. To this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before, except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate that job in Hollywood, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on that bar stool and I drank those drinks, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. So I sat on that bar stool and I lost them both in one fell swoop. The kid and the job were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month there, till I fell into another job at another dive bar. And there was always one more, isn't there? And I met the man that I would eventually marry there. You know, I thought maybe if I made my life look like yours was, get it back together, get a husband, move into an apartment, get out of this business. It's this business. Get the kid back, you know, put it all back together. It's got to be okay then. Fresh start. He and I got married about the time we should have split up. And we moved into that apartment and we settled our arguments with a shotgun. You know, I mean, that, you know, whoever gets to the shotgun first wins. We became the neighborhood entertainment. And my first exposure to AA that I could remember. Now, see, I'm going to say that, and then I'm going to tell you this. I had been exposed to AA many times before this. So this is when I started to listen. This is when I started to perk up. Because in those, in the rehab and in juvenile hall, and we had panels come in from AA. We had people come in and talk to us about AA. But it wasn't for me, and I can look you in the eye and tell you, I looked them in the eye and knew it wasn't for me, it wasn't mine. You know, and for a few years, I had a panel that I took into juvenile hall earlier in my sobriety, and I'd sit and I'd talk to those girls, and it wasn't for them. They'd look me straight in the eye, and it wasn't for them. I'm not an alcoholic, but my mama is. So the first time I remember being exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I could grasp it was after one of our fights, my fights with my husband. And we were at the bar where we drank, and we ended up, you know, in a big brawl, and I ended up with black eyes and broken ribs, and nobody in the bar feeling sorry. You know how that goes. I mean, a lot of you know. I know you do. You know, they're just sick of it. They're sick of you. They're sick of it. I'm sick of me. We're all sick of it. And he picks me up, and he takes me to the hospital, and I got fixed up, and he brought me home, and he had to leave for work that weekend, so before he did, I was, you know, healing, nursing myself up in the bedroom upstairs, and so he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. Now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me so mean. I mean, you understand. I don't know if we have any drunk dialers in the room, but I started drinking the gin and dialing the phone. And I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman, so I called a battered woman's shelter. And I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. I don't know how she made that leap, but she did. I found an AA meeting not far from where I lived. It was a perfectly wonderful meeting, almost right around the corner, you know what I mean? It was like right there. It was there then and there now. And I went in there with everything but readiness. Everything but readiness. I went in there hurting. I went in there but with everything but readiness. And there was a woman speaker that night. I remember that. And she talked for about 45 minutes, just like I am now. And the only thing I heard her say was that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer. So I did. Walked out of there thinking, the representative from Alcoholics Anonymous said, we switched to beer. You know, because beer's not really drinking anyway, right? It's more like a breakfast food, I think. It's you know, it's got hops and barley and wheat, and I mean, it's a whole grain breakfast food, really. So it's kind of good for you. But it gave me the illusion that I was controlling my drinking. You know, it allowed me to get a little further in my day before I fell over, before I fell apart. Well, that lasted another couple years. My husband and I had moved into a little apartment across town in Pasadena. We'd gotten the kid back for better or worse. Now she was almost 10 years old. I'd gotten a little job answering phones for the city, right, fresh start. You know, and I would try. You know in your heart sometimes you want to do good. I wanted to do good. No, we're not going to stop drinking, but I want to do well. You know, I know what I know. And so there'd be some mornings where I'd want to try to get to work. Can I just get to work without taking those morning drinks that stop the shakes? Can I just get there? Can I just do that? Can I just last till the first break? Let's try that. And then what I found myself in that last year was that I'm in that torturous state of drinking or thinking about drinking. I'm either drinking or thinking about drinking all day long. We finally ended up one Saturday afternoon with the cops in the driveway one more time, the neighbors peeking out the window, watching us, wondering what's going on in Charlie and Carla's house one more time. The kids standing over in the corner in her mismatched clothes and her unkempt hair, and she got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. And I can't try to tell her it's going to be any different. Hadn't been different in a very long time. I didn't wake up expecting that. I woke up thinking if everybody would be cool, we'll all be all right. You know, everybody stay in their places. So finally the husband left, the cops left, they took the gun, everybody's gone, it's me and the kid in the booze, and I can't stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. And by now I know that it's got something to do with it. But I can't, you know, the idea of being sober, the idea of, you know, I know what I'm like untreated. I know what I'm like without the booze. My first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole thing go down that last day. And a couple days later, she came and she knocked on my door and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And I invited her in and she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention, you know? Because untreated, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. You know, and it's sooner or later, my head just gets louder and louder and louder, and it closes in on me. You know, so much so that even though I look at that first drink and I know that I can't guarantee if I'm going to have 2 or 22, even though I know I don't have to invite trouble anymore, trouble shows up unsolicited in my life. It just is there, you know. Even though I know, I'm still going to have to pick it up because I've got nothing that stands between me. Even though I know that window of relief gets smaller and smaller and smaller, you know, it's going to be a good 5-10 minutes, you know. It's going to work. So I don't know how her 12 thinly veiled Sunday school sentences are going to have any big effect on me in the face of what I've become. It seemed like I'd heard all those before, right? They just seem so pale. So pale. Thank God I was finally, you know, beat up. I was finally beaten into that state of reasonableness because they, you know, maybe. Maybe enough to shake it out a week later, and after I shook it out, go back to my neighbor and ask her what to do. I didn't need anybody to tell me that at that point. Something had happened inside already. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't see it happening while it was happening, but something started to happen. And I went back to my neighbor after I shook it out. I shook it out for a weekend and then a couple of days, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, and that became my first home group. And I went up there. I just did it. I just did it. I don't know why this time. I just did it. I didn't think about it. I just did it. And went up there and sat way back by the exit sign just in case. And the hope I heard in that room that night came in the form of small talk. And I don't know why it was, but I heard it. You guys seem to care about each other. You know, how you doing? Do you have a sponsor? Yeah, did you get a big book? Didn't you have a job interview yesterday? How'd that go? How's your kid? How are they doing? How's your lawn? God, can my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? I mean, other than to, you know, pass out on. You know? So I heard it, and at the end of that meeting that night, the secretary came back and she did something very nice for me, and I didn't know how nice it was till later, but she asked me to read that portion of chapter 11 that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, A Vision for You. And I said yes. I said yes, and I started to read, and as I read, I came into the room just a little bit, just like I do every time I say yes to whatever it is you ask me to do. I'm stacking chairs, I'm in the room. I'm pouring coffee, I'm in the room. I'm sticking my hand out, I'm in the room. When you tell me to keep coming back, words I hadn't heard in a long, long time, I'm in the room, and I'm back in the room, and I'm back in the room, and I'm staying sober a midnight at a time. And I kept doing that because it was working. You know, and not that the obsession was lifted for me right away, and it wasn't that I didn't have a good sense of my disease. I was surrendered to how bad it was. I just didn't know if this was going to be the thing that worked. But so far, so good, you know. I started to go to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I was starting to show up at work. I was able to show up. That obsession didn't leave me till I was about 9 months sober and in the middle of my amends. You know, I was not one of those people, you know, that I just, you know, I hope that it happens for you. I hope you walk through the doors and, like, you know, you just don't have that horror. Not the thought to drink, but I mean that horrible on my ass. Am I going to drink today? Am I not going to drink? Am I going to drink? As you know, I mean, I had to learn to get from the bed to the coffee pot to the shower to the car, and the car to work. You know, and then pay attention. Where am I? I'm right here. I'm sitting down. I'm wearing red shoes. I've got, you know, the pencil in my hand. And I took the steps with my sponsor. I went out one more time. I went out at 89 days, and that first step edge came back. I wasn't quite trusting the solution. I thought a big book and a beer sounded much better. And then I came back in full force. I was all in. And you guys gave me commitments. And, And I love these little jobs we get in the rooms, you know, stacking chairs or pouring coffee or making coffee. You know, it gets me in the rooms, especially that coffee making job. You know, I mean, I got out of work at 5 o'clock, and at 5:05 I'm in the meeting, even though the meeting didn't start till 8, because I'm buying stir sticks and coffee and cakes and trying to figure out who needs a card and whose birthday is it and what's going on, you know, and I'm not thinking about me. And that's how I discovered the absence of the noise on the inside of my own head, thinking about you. I didn't understand the intellectual, you know, self-centeredness or the definition of self-centered. You know, is it on me now? Am I doing it? I don't know. But when I took the actions you suggested, I started to experience that lack of the noise on the inside of my own head. And if you're new, I hope that you just start doing some things. Just if your sponsor tells you to do something, just do it. Don't stand there trying to figure it out first. Try it and see what happens. You know? I don't know how long I can go without just staying sober on somebody else's experience anyway. You know, I got to do it. I made that first round of amends to my family at about 9 months, and my family deserved and still gets a lot of follow up. You know, it took a long time. You know, we wrapped this thing up from the podium in one of these meetings like some bad chapter of Law and Order. You know, and then we got the law and the order, and boom, we're done. You know, and it sounds like woo, that went fast. You know, for them, but it's 25 years we're talking about. You know, and you told me that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. Just do, you know, do what's in front of you. It was so much easier for me, so simple. Do what's in front of me. Call my sponsor, show up to meetings, go to work. To this day, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, "No, please don't go to the meeting." You know, they never do that. Then other women started to ask me to sponsor them, and I got to tell you, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see redemption, and I see forgivability, and I see lovability, and I see hope where I don't, and growth where I don't always see to myself. And something very special happens when two alcoholics talk at that level. When the light comes on in you, it burns brighter in me. Then I'd had you guys for a couple of years. My daughter didn't have anybody, and she was starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang and starting to find a sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. It was time to get her some big help. You know, and it was for me to do that. Whether or not she ever wanted a relationship with me, it was for me to do that. She was pretty angry. You know, she was saying things like, "I'm going to bust a cap in your ass," or "I'm going to have my friends bust a cap in your ass." You know, that's not like, "No, I don't want to do my homework." And so I put her in this treatment center. I found this place that was just right. And she was there for 6 months, and it was for me to show up. And we got better. It wasn't perfect, but we got better. And when she got out, she was with me for a while, and then she wanted to go live with her dad. And I had to back up and let her go do that, and pick her up on my weekends, and do the deal, you know, and stay full bore in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And like it was said in our reading just before we even started this meeting, I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is the best place to be a mess. I cannot be worried about looking good in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I'm the one whose head goes home and lays on my pillow. You know, I'm the one. I can look good for you guys all day long, but I gotta be real, and I gotta tell on myself, and I don't have to tell it to everybody. I don't have to work it out from the podium, but I've got a few friends and a sponsor that help me out, that walk me through this stuff, and that's what the fellowship's for here, in my view. That we walk you through while that internal thing is happening, while that inside job is going on. We walk you through it. And you never know, you know, you never know. Life makes strange bedfellows. You never know who's going to be the one to help you or who's going to come up and ask you for help. Anyway, at 5 years of sobriety, I went to bed one night, and I woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back, and he raped me and he robbed me in my own bed. And I got to tell you, at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. You know, when I got here, I was a bewildered one. I had so many disjointed ideas of faith that I didn't really know which one to pick. And so when I got here, a lady named Susan said, why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be in your life? Why don't you just start there? And then the second step, at the end of the chapter to the agnostics, it says, when we drew near, he disclosed himself to us. And I took that as a promise, and I called him on his promise. And it asked me a question. Am I willing to believe? I'm not going to quote it right tonight, but do I now believe or am I willing to believe that a power greater than myself can solve my problem, can and will solve my problem? Do I believe that God's everything or he's nothing? And if God's everything, I'm part of that. I'm part of the everything. And if I'm part of the everything, there's nothing else, and things are as they should be, even if I don't like it. So the guy was there for a few hours, and then he left out the same window he came in, and it turned out that I knew him, and I actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back, and then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind, and when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is, while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I come here to remember who and what I am, and then I can go anywhere I want to and worship, if that's what I want to do. My sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. I know that at 5 years of sobriety, I know what resentment does to color my present moment. I know what it does. I can color whole groups of people with one idea of something that happened way back when. They're no longer even anywhere near in my life, and I'm still living it. So I know that I got to let it go. But I still sometimes labor under that belief that if I hang on, you know, you deserve it. You deserve it. You know, and it's me who's stuck. It's me. But I can't let go because he scared me. I don't know how to get from here to there. Thank God for that seven-step prayer. That seven-step prayer became my mantra. I don't know how to change. I don't know how to let go of anger. Anger at 5 years of sobriety was my favorite way to go. And yet it's like a suit that doesn't fit anymore. I can't be angry and I can't not be angry. And it's got to go. My ego says, if I die, you die. If you let go, they're going to walk all over you. And underneath all that, what's stronger than all of that noise in my head is God. And I had to keep reaching every day. Tenacity. Because I know it's there. You know, but the fear is so big. Anyway, I better get going here. There was a court trial that followed. They got him, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the guys I'd known years before get up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband, and that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of the rapist than he was for me. And then I had to get a character witness for me as to who I was at 5 years of sobriety. And by that time, I was working at a big financial firm downtown Los Angeles. Big place. I never even walked in the front doors of years before, you know. Big, fancy place. Henry Kissinger walked the halls there, you know. And I walked undetected. I had been walking undetected through those halls for a few years by then. So the department head there volunteered to come and testify on my behalf. And they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early and she stays late. And she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify. And I want to tell you here that it was for me to testify. It was for me to forgive. And it was for me to hold him accountable. And the two could happen at the same time. You know, it was the behavior. So I'm sitting in the witness stand. I'm still saying that prayer, that little recipe for forgiveness we have on page 67. And I'm a page quoter. I don't apologize for that. Because if I misquote, I want you to know where to find it. You know, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way they manifested, he, like me, was perhaps spiritually sick. Not me from a spiritual hilltop, but he, like me. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat, and have. And what happened for me in that moment was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And just like a little crack of light under the doorway, that ability to start to relinquish the fear that brought on the nightmares, the fear that brought on the defensive and guardedness, the fear, and surrender that. And after about 18 months, the nightmares and all that stuff kind of went away, finally went away. And he was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17, and he's not been able to stay out as far as I know. I get the letters, you know, when he's being released. But I know it works in prison. I've had the privilege of going up there and talking to those guys, some of whom are never getting out. And I know that they've found a way through Alcoholics Anonymous to be of service to each other and to the people that they've harmed. I've seen it. They walk spiritually free. Even though they might trade with us physically, they walk spiritually free. The detective who worked that case came to me and he said, "I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know. But whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it because it seems to be working." And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. I'm just going to tell you quickly that I made amends to my family. And my family was, you know, my dad doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. You know, he sleeps well and he knows why. And my mom, about 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17 and took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in the West Covina Hospital, the family would wait in the waiting room, and I'd go out to the parking lot where my car was and where the booze was, and I'd drink, and I'd come back into that waiting room, and I'd rake my mother across the coals, and I'd talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, except I started to call her once a week, try to find out how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. And it required some listening. And I discovered that that's what she really wanted. She wanted me to be there. And I stayed present for her. And not that she didn't do a whole lot for me, but I'm just saying from my end, it was for me to open up. And we got pretty close, so much so that about 10 years, and now it's been about 12 years since my baby brother died of this disease. He was 6'10", 30 years old, 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in the Spokane Hospital. Little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. And mercifully, when he died, I got to go and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried dead a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And when she died of end-stage liver disease almost 4 years ago, we were clean and clear. We were clean and clear, and I got to go up there and be with my stepfather. And my stepfather, when he found out that Doug and I were getting together and we were headed down the road to matrimony, he called me and he said, "I know that your mother left you all her jewelry, including her wedding rings. And what I'd like to do is to give Doug mine so that the rings will be together again." And so we went up there. We went up there 1 year, and we wear my mother's and my stepfather's wedding rings, and they were the loves of each other's lives. You know, her third one was the charm. And my daughter came back to live with me, and I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson, and we just watched him graduate from high school last week. You know, and we got to come full circle. Her senior year of high school she was pregnant, and she was homeschooled, and we have a picture of her in her cap and gown with her, my father, me, and we're holding the baby in the basket. And so last week we're taking a picture of him. And we've come full circle. And a couple years ago I sat with both of the boys, both of my grandsons, and watched their mother graduate from college. And she's working on her master's now. And, you know, we've come full circle. And I'm going to leave you with this story, and because I like it and I think it's fun. And then I'm going to sit down. I got to stay grateful. You know, I got to stay grateful. That morning routine, I don't meditate twice a day because I haven't done it. I have some quiet time at night, but in the morning I need that time. I need that time that they talk about on pages 84, 85, and 86, you know, 87, about remembering who and what I am and remembering that alcohol is a subtle foe and getting some quiet time and improving that conscious contact. If conscious separation is my problem, conscious contact is my solution. And every day I get up and when I make that conscious contact, I have a grateful day. I can think of things to be grateful for. I count my blessings and I'm on the good foot, right? I get started and I go out there and I see the world from a whole different angle. It's kind of like this pit bull puppy that we were fostering just a couple of years ago, you know. And she wasn't in our lives for long, but she reminded me to be grateful. You know, she reminded me about that joy of the moment. You know, and this is how it would go. Like, I'd get up in the morning and I'd have this bowl full of food. And it was the same food she saw last night and the same food she saw yesterday afternoon and the day before and the day before that. I'd set it down in front of her and she'd look at it and she'd look at me and look at it and look at me and she'd be like, "We're going to eat.
then she'd get done eating and she'd run into our bedroom and she'd get up on the bed and she'd see Doug and she'd see me, the same faces she saw last night and the day before and the day before that and the day before that. And she'd be like, oh! It's you. We're going to party. So she'd sit with us for a little while and then she'd jet out the backyard and she'd go running around the backyard, you know, just like, party, you know, just around in circles. Same yard she was in yesterday and last night. You know, just like goldfish mentality. You know, ooh, a castle, ooh, a castle, ooh, a castle. You know, and just, you know, joy of the moment, just gleeful. And when I've made that conscious contact in the morning, upon awakening, I make that conscious contact and I say my prayers and I go sit and I'm with my God. I get to feel that gratitude. I get to experience that. And when I don't, when I blow past that that first moment in the morning and I go right for the coffee and I forget, and I will. I have. You know, and I just going through the day and the day, me and myself, we're going to solve the day's problems. Before I know it, I am sitting in front of the computer looking for a fight on Facebook. Don't like. Delete, defriend, comment. So I want to tell you that I've got a good life. I've got a life I never would have known to ask for. And that's how I know there's a God in my life today. Because He answers questions I don't even ask out loud. I don't always even know they need asking. But I'm here, and if you're new, I hope that you'll stay here long enough for it to happen for you. Thank you for my life.